Thank you. All right, you guys can go ahead and turn in your Bibles to Job chapter 25. We forge ahead in this study. As we turn to this next chapter, we're coming to the what you just might refer to as the conclusion of the third round of dialogues. We've been in this large dialogue section of Job, this section in which Job is going back and forth with these various speeches, him delivering them and then his three friends, or I should say it begins with Eliphaz, one of the friends, and it goes back and forth between Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. So we've seen two dialogues transpire, and we've been in this third and final dialogue between these three friends. And we began our study several weeks ago of this particular round of dialogues, this third and final round of dialogues in these series of speeches. And as we began to introduce this new section, we highlighted several distinguishing characteristics of this particular section and in this dialogue, things that are differentiated from the other two dialogues. And as we come to chapter 25 and Bildad's speech and then Job's follow-up to that, we basically are coming to a place that, in a sense, it puts a bigger spotlight on some of those differentiators that we discussed previously. The first thing that you'll notice if you just take a quick glance at chapter 25 and Bildad's speech, it is six verses. It barely constitutes a chapter if you think of it in terms of just what looks like it should be a full chapter, particularly in the flow of this narrative in this book. And also, we noted before, but as we are talking about concluding this third cycle of speeches, we're coming to the end, but we're not going to hear from Zophar, the third of the three friends. And so we're moving to this place where there is this very brief and abrupt speech from Bildad, and then Zophar's absence. And we're also going to kind of make this turn into what is a very lengthy section where Job kind of continues to speak. And so this third round of dialogues, it in some ways makes it difficult, and there's some measure of debate amongst scholars as to where the third round of dialogues ends and where something else is beginning, because Job kind of goes on and on for a little bit at the conclusion of this back and forth dialogue section. I just want to note some things here by way of introduction to kind of frame up our thinking and also to maybe encourage us and help us as we try to grapple with our understanding of this book. It's not an easy book to just lift up off the page verse by verse and understand maybe what the Lord would want to teach us specifically from it. We certainly can pick up the broad sweeps and themes and the main points, if you will. Those are rather obvious. But when you sort of read through and look at these dialogues going back and forth, it can get somewhat tedious and maybe even a little bit confusing. But as we come to this section, and really, we've already been in it a little bit. Some would argue it goes back to chapter 24. But there are significant disagreements amongst Old Testament scholars and commentators on this book regarding whether or not portions, particularly of Job's speeches in this third round, should really be attributed to Job. Some would argue that really portions of Job's speeches should be attributed to Bildad, and that's why you have just six verses here in our current version. And so the missing verses from Bildad are really contained in what is currently in our translation we have today. It's attributed to Job, but it really belongs to Bildad. Others would add to that or augment that case by saying that portions of Job's dialogues are really Zophar. And so the fact that Zophar is not showing up here, well, It's really not the case. What's happened is that in the inscripturation process over time and the scribal process and, you know, going back to oral tradition and then getting all the way forward to the translations that we have today, there were things that were lost or wrongly attributed, misappropriated in the transmission of Scripture to its current form. And so we're sort of left, if you listen to some of that commentary, we're sort of left with, what does this mean? How do we sort this out? I mean, is this the extent of what Bildad has to say? If we are those who believe that all Scripture is inspired by God and it's useful for teaching and instruction and reproof so that we might be mature, we might be complete, we might have all that we need to serve God well and serve His people well. If we believe that, then it stands to reason that it would be important for us to maybe understand, well, how do we interpret this? There, just to give you an example, I want to kind of give you an example of how pronounced this sort of reattribution argument can get. In the New Bible Commentary, the writer of that commentary is a scholar named David Clines. And in his commentary, he's referring all the way back to Eliphaz's speech in Job 24. It's where his sort of argument for this reordering of things begins. He says this regarding Job 24, verses 18 to 25. He says, some of this section is so unlike Job's argument that we have to assume that it must really be the friends who are speaking here. Now, I say to you, did you guys know that? Were you aware of that? You're reading this, and all along you're thinking, I've been getting it all wrong. In other words, there's sort of like almost a, you know, Old Testament scholarly Gnosticism going on here, this secret knowledge that you have to have. And if you didn't happen to, you know, have your handy version of Logos Bible study application with this commentary loaded in it, you'd never know this. But he goes on. That's not all. Not only do we have to assume that Job 24, verses 18 to 25, which is part of Job's speech, we must assume that it's really his friends who are speaking there. He goes on to give some greater specificity. He says, it is the friends who say that the guilty are nothing but foam on the surface of the water, verse 18. That the underworld soon snatches them away, verse 19. That they are not remembered long, verse 20. That however important they seem, they are soon cut off like ears of corn, verse 24. And then he goes on to say, perhaps these verses were originally the missing end of Bildad's speech. Clines opens his comments on Bildad's third speech in chapter 25 that we're going to be looking at today by saying that something, he says, seems wrong with the text at this point. Bildad's speech begins without the usual address and is only five verses long. There is no speech from Zophar at all, and there are three speeches of Job in a row without any words from the friends. Some of the passages in Job's speeches here do not sound like him at all. Perhaps Bildad's speech was originally chapter 25, verses 2 through 6, plus chapter 26, verses 5 through 14. Now, how would you like to have to put that puzzle together just out of osmosis, out of the air, to know how this is supposed to flow? You start reading this, and it's like it gets kind of unnerving if you take it at face value. I am not equipped as just an average, common, you know, proletariat Christian, not in the elite class. I am not capable of properly interpreting this if all this is the case. Continuing on with this reattribution idea, Klein's says this about Job's response to Bildad in chapter 26. He says, speaking of chapter 26, he says, verses 5 through 14 are perhaps really part of Bildad's third speech. So he's yanking and pulling from all over the place and reattributing, at least in his estimation, sections of Job's speech to either or Bildad or Zophar. Partly because, you know, Bildad's speech is just too short. Which, by the way, is a very scholarly conclusion to draw, I would say. Even beyond chapter 26, Kleins continues to make the case that there are obvious attribution errors in Job's speeches. Regarding Job's remarks in chapter 27 and 28, Kleins states this: again, we face the problem of who is really speaking in these chapters. There is no doubt that chapter 27, verses 2 through 12, we have the genuine voice of Job. Well, thank you for that confirmation. But perhaps the rest of chapters 27 and 28 are not from his lips. He surely is not repeating the same stale ideas on the fate of the wicked that the friends have uttered. Perhaps 27 verse 13 through 28:28 was originally the third speech of Zophar. For the themes we find here, the fate of the wicked, the secret wisdom of God, and the duty of humans to do righteousness and avoid evil, have previously been made by Zophar. Now, you may be asking yourself at this point why I'm deluging you with this tedious detail from the world of commentators of Job. It's a fair question, so let me offer up a couple of answers. First, sometimes I think it's appropriate and even important and helpful for us to point out from time to time what I view as a sort of bold presumption on the part of biblical scholars and commentators. I know that this man, whom I don't know personally, but I know that he used terms like perhaps along the way, but he also sets you ill at ease by his other more definitive conclusive statements and terminology. So to me, there's sort of like a boldness there, a presumptive boldness there that just kind of makes me very uneasy to observe. And I think it's helpful for us from time to time, especially as we study the scriptures the way we do here, to sort of highlight some of those occasions, to make note of that, and have it kind of inform our approach to scripture and its proper understanding and interpretation ourselves. Certainly, as we've talked about before, and as you've observed in your own reading, there are very real linguistic and structural, and you might even say even interpretive challenges and difficulties in the book of Job that are unique to the book of Job, and they do have to be dealt with in some way. So I'm not advocating for, you know, just intellectual ignorance here, just avoiding the sticky wickets altogether. I'd simply want to make the point that this kind of meddling with the text that is kind of being suggested here by this commentator, and by the way, that's just a sample. That's just one example. There's many. There's many that I could have pulled. Okay, I just gave you that one example, not to pile onto one individual. But this kind of meddling with the text that I just illustrated from Kleins, first of all, I think it's just simply unwarranted. It's just not necessary, and I think maybe worse, in some way, it just strikes me as bending toward a form of arrogance that's kind of troubling to me. And then the second reason I would point to is that, as we've all noticed, and you don't have to be a scholar or a reader of commentaries to notice this, we've all noticed that there are very purposeful themes of transcendent mystery and human anguish and confusion, of escalating relational conflict. I mean, that's been on display in a massive way as we've looked at these dialogues. Conflict and turmoil in relationships. And even as we've arrived here at the end, just plain old exasperation in the whole debate. Just tired of talking. Enough has been said. And it runs all through the book. And we've seen that. We've observed that. And so it would seem to me that it would make sense that in the context of what we have here is ancient Hebrew poetry, that we should expect those kinds of themes to be reflected in the language and structure of the book. And we've actually pointed to that from time to time. And I find it rather ironic, as I've thought about this, that the commentators who tend to take liberties with the text and chopping it up and rearranging chunks of the text, that these commentators seem to be driven by a desire to line everything up that in a way that it rings true. It makes them feel better about the logical coherence of things in the book. And to kind of smooth out some of these twists and turns that don't make sense to them. And my take on it all is that it doesn't make sense to the actual characters in the story. They're struggling to make sense of it. What's being pushed to us, and what we will see again today, is the need for us to have a degree of humility before this kind of mystery, as opposed to an insistence on knowing everything in every detail when it comes to the plans and workings of God. The very meaning and thrust of the book, in my estimation, is in the exact opposite direction as what seems to be the driver behind this rearranging and extrapolating and pulling from here and moving to there to kind of smooth things out. So let me read another excerpt from the Cornerstone Bible commentary that I think takes the right approach to all this. So I gave you, an unsettling example. Let me kind of bring us back to what I think is a very helpful and balanced perspective on all this. In this commentary, the writer states this: "The closing poem of Job's speech is generally regarded as being in complete disarray and possibly out of place. Commentators have rearranged verses or regarded them as being unintelligible. Others have been more radical in providing a different arrangement of chapters 24 through 27, assuming that the disorder extends to this entire section." This particular writer goes on and kind of concludes by saying, "There is no warrant for such changes from the Septuagint or the oldest Aramaic Targum from the Qumran," these ancient texts from which we get our current translations. He says, "We must assume that the text we possess is reasonably intact, was so structured by the author, and was so preserved because it carried meaning in that form." And that's what resonates with me as I think about this, as I've tried to take in, along with all of you, this flow of this narrative and tried to kind of understand what it is we're seeing and what we're witnessing, and even wrestling with my own inclination toward logical coherence and certitude about what stuff means, my own, at times, hubris on that front. That for us to stand before a narrative like this, a retelling of something that happened in ancient times with one of God's choicest servants, to stand before the retelling of that with the appropriate humility that it is calling for, even in the body of the narrative itself. And to also be encouraged by the reality of mystery in the midst of suffering, the reality of persistent injustice in a fallen world. As we talked about last week, this is indeed one of the means that God uses amongst His redeemed people to remind them and to instill in them a particular type of hope that all things are not yet right. You are correct. Look upon it, see it, feel the weight of it, smell the aroma of the corruption around us, so that you can then be infused with hope for that better day. We need to be reminded of these things. So with that in view, let's pick up where we left off last week, and let's go to this particular section by way of review as we transition into Bildad's response. This was what was happening with Job as we looked at his lament in chapter 24. We talked last week about sort of the ingredients of this lament, and we really tried to put a fine point on the fact that lament is good and healthy and helpful and is appropriate for the believer who recognizes that not all has been redeemed, even though we are among the redeemed. And that we live in a world that is awaiting that full and final redemption, and it should fill us with hope, but it should also infuse us with purpose and mission. And yet we still find ourselves at times either going through the travails of suffering and trial that are invariably the consequence of the fall, even if it might not be a direct correlated consequence of your individual sin. I'm not going to be one of Job's friends here. But we suffer because we're under the curse. Our bodies are decaying, and we suffer illness. We catch viruses. We have conflict with those that are closest to us and those whom we don't even know. We're slandered and we're reviled. And we have to fight for hope and trust in the Lord all the time because of the nature of the world in which we live. And it's in that process of grappling with the suffering that we are then turned to our Redeemer, who is our ultimate hope, and to that day in which redemption will be full and final. But Job, as we looked at last week, is in this lament of a different type and a different tone than what we've seen from him before. In previous laments, he is very much bemoaning his condition and the degree of his suffering and the extent of his vexation and lack of understanding of what God is doing and why God is doing it. In this lament, in chapter 24, he is lamenting the suffering broadly around him, with a particular focus on the suffering of the most vulnerable, those who are oppressed, the poor, the sort of the helpless, even pointing to the decidedly vulnerable, the orphan and the widow, as a way to bring that point to bear in a pronounced and pointed kind of way. And he's appealing to this question of why and how long, Lord? How long must we wait for your day of judgment? Why must we endure this kind of suffering? Why do these most vulnerable among us have to endure this suffering? Oftentimes at the hands of those who are in temporal terms, the strong or the mighty. And why are those who are characterized by wickedness, who thrive in darkness and who believe that their deeds can be gotten away with under the cover of darkness, why do they seem to be preserved? These questions of why and how long persist, and even the recognition that this kind of suffering is pervasive and widespread. I can focus on myself for a moment and recognize that, man, I'm really going through it, but I just open up my eyes and I recognize in a global way there is just pain and suffering in order of magnitude that is hard to take in and bear. Why, Lord? How long is the nature of the lament? And there's this, even at the end of this lament, there's this almost resignation that it seems in a temporal sense rather pointless. I mean, even if I can point to and lament the suffering of the innocent and the vulnerable, rightly so, and I can lament the fact that those who perpetrate harm on the most vulnerable and those that do deeds of wickedness under the cover of darkness, and those who seem to prosper even in their wickedness and suffer no harm or no justice in this temporal time frame, all of those people, all of those cases end in the same way. They all suffer the same demise. So there's a certain pointlessness that's even expressed in all of this, at least on a temporal plane. And again, I remind you that we're watching Job go through this process. The Lord, in his wisdom, is taking us through Job's process of really coming face to face with his Redeemer and his God. So he's suffering, or he's lamenting the suffering that is so widespread and so comprehensive. And that's the nature of what Job speaks to in chapter 24. And then in response to all of this, in six very brief verses, Bildad manages to once again completely miss the mark while at the same time saying some true things. That's been the nature of this all along. We haven't been able to point to Job's friends and say, well, that's wrong, and that's wrong, and that's wrong, and that's wrong. We'd be like, no, that's actually true. Yeah, that's an accurate reflection of the character of God or the power of God or the dominion of God. Yeah, that's true. But what we see here in these brief six verses is Bildad saying some true things, but missing the mark. And so let's look at it. Let's try to identify what we're seeing here in these brief verses in Job 25. It says, then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, dominion and fear are with God. He makes peace in his high heaven. Is there any number to his armies? Upon whom does his light not arise? How then can man be in the right before God? How can he who is born of a woman be pure? Behold, even the moon is not bright, and the stars are not pure in his eyes. How much less man who is a maggot, the son of man who is a worm? Be warm and be filled. There you have it, Job. That's the message. God is high and holy, and man, including the poor and oppressed, the widows and the orphans that you're droning on about and lament, they're all maggots and worms. That's the calculus. Now, how is that, I ask? How is that for a timely and discerning conveyance of the doctrine of original sin and the depravity of man? I would subscribe to the doctrine of original sin. I would subscribe to the doctrine of the depravity of man. You could certainly do a search throughout the scriptures and you could find similar characterizations of comparison of the wickedness of men and the ungodliness and unrighteousness of men as compared to the holiness of God. So true things. But we've covered this principle on multiple occasions because these cycles of dialogues have made it so plain for us, but I think it bears repeating here. Simply this, and as I'm sure most of you know this and have experienced this yourself, but good and effective counsel is not merely speaking truth to people who are struggling. It is speaking truth in the right way and at the right time. It's not a complicated principle, but it is a profoundly important one. Is it indeed true? Can we kind of have a consensus of agreement here that believers who are in the throes of deep and profound suffering, they're in the deep weeds of a trial? Is it not true that people who are going through something like that don't often see things clearly? Is that not true? Can we agree on that? Can you confess to that yourself? I can. And isn't it absolutely essential that we root our counsel deeply in the clear, objective, and transformative and powerful Word of God? Isn't that what we should root our counsel in? Can we agree on that? I think so. But isn't it also true that we can become quickly uncomfortable in counseling situations when we hear someone trying to articulate their pain, and in so doing, they're articulating their pain in ways that seem to us detached from the truth? We can feel uncomfortable with that, right? I mean, what we're hearing, we're going, wait, that's not true. That doesn't line up with the doctrine of the sovereignty of God, or that's not a clear understanding of the way God's providence works amongst the affairs of men, or That's not an accurate characterization of the provision of God or the eternal purposes of God, whatever it might be. We were like, whoa, hey. You know, we get uncomfortable. It comes at our deep conviction about counseling from what is true. And doesn't that discomfort often compel us to want to correct error before we convey sympathy and loving kindness? Is that a possible error we could make? It's obviously not an either or in counseling, shepherding, and discipleship. It's a both and. But we look at Bildad, and it's like Job's lamenting all these things, and there's not an ounce of shared sympathy that's expressed. There's not an ounce of appropriate commiserating. It's just straight to God is holy, and you're a maggot and a worm. So just deal with it. This is where we are with Bildad and, frankly, with Eliphaz too. And by implication, Zophar. Zophar, can you imagine what Zophar might have said? Probably would have had to put, you know, a rating warning on the section of Zophar's words in his final statement if he had one in the third round. As hot as he came in his first two speeches. And did you notice in Bildad's speech, there was this combination of definitiveness, of certitude, and hopelessness? How is that going to be helpful to someone who's suffering? Being completely certain of indeed truthful truths, and yet offering up no hope. That's what we see in Bildad's speech. This is who God is. This is who you are. So just deal with it. Now, obviously, this is a, you might say, an exaggerated illustration for us to kind of make the point. I'm rather certain, at least I hope I can be certain, that most of us are not employing, you know, the Bildad school of counseling on a regular basis in our conversations with people. But I do think it is a challenge for us to really, you know, be surveying the motives of our hearts and the thinking that we might be employing as we're dealing with people who are expressing lament. They're just crying out. They're asking why and how long. They're not necessarily making a theological treatise. They're feeling the weight and the burden of suffering. They're suffering because they're seeing the suffering of someone else that they love and care about. And it's just weighing them down. And they literally are confused and perplexed and not even able to think clearly and then therefore articulate what they're feeling or thinking clearly. And so we need to be recognizing that for what it is, and certainly, ultimately, and in time, bringing truth to bear, but not absent hope and not absent sympathy. In other words, we speak the truth, but we speak it at the right time and in the right way. That's what we want to do. With his last words, this is his last sort of statement on the matter. This is basically the last statement of any of these three friends. So you could say this is the climactic moment for these three friends' counsel. And basically all Bildad does is repeat what Eliphaz has already said. He just continues to hammer home that singular point. You see in chapter 25, verse 3, is there any number of to his armies upon whom does his light not arise? And Eliphaz says in chapter 5, verse 9, who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number? The vastness, the inability to count all the ways that God works in his power. And here in Bildad's speech in the first part of verse 4, how then can man be in the right before God? Well, Eliphaz said this in chapter 4, verse 17, and in chapter 15, verse 14. Same question. Can mortal man be in the right before God? Can a man be pure before his maker? What is man that he can be pure, or he who is born of a woman that he can be righteous? It's the same thing. So multiple occasions, I could go verse by verse and I could draw corollaries to what Eliphaz has already said. So in all of this definitiveness, in all of this certitude, he's not saying anything new or not saying anything that hasn't already been said to Job by the friend that was right next to him. So it's almost like a double whammy. Like he's not even reading the room and seeing how this might land on Job. Maybe I should take a different tact. Maybe I should try a little bit of a different angle. He's not even doing that. Just saying the same things. Just even more abruptly. Let me just boil it down to this, you maggot, you worm. And as I said, it's without hope, and it's devoid of any of the attributes of God's grace or his loving kindness, his nature as a provider or a redeemer. And thankfully, we have been able to see that Job is in contrast to that. Even as we have seen Job struggle and say things that make us uncomfortable, and even that are not accurate reflections of the way that God works in his justice. He's not expressing a lack of faith and trust. He's not denying his maker, but he is crying out from time to time in anguish in ways that make us uncomfortable. But all the way through, going back to chapter 1 and continuing all the way up to chapter 23, you see Job holding on to hope because there's hope if there is a Redeemer. And the God that I know ultimately is a just Redeemer. In Job 1:21, you recall, shortly after these trials befell him, he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In chapter 13, verse 15, he says, "Though he slay me, I will hope in him. Yet I will argue my ways to his face." In Job chapter 16, verse 19, he says, "Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and he who testifies for me is on high." He has cried out, "Where are you? I don't see you. I don't understand, but I know you're there. I don't feel better. I'm not comforted. My pain is still with me, but I know you're there." Do you hear that? Job chapter 19, verses 25 to 27. "For I know that my Redeemer lives. And at the last, he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself. And my eyes shall behold, and not another. Yet my heart faints within me." And then chapter 23, verse 10. "But he knows the way that I take. When he has tried me, I shall come out as gold." He's still saying in that context, "I look here and you're not there. I know you're working, but I can't see you." But he also says this. This is the heartbeat of Job in and through all of these ups and downs and these twists and turns and these cries of anguish and this battle for hope and for trust and for confidence in the Lord. It's the theme that runs through it all that we have to grab hold of when we're walking through this and seeing this unhelpful counsel from his friends. So let's turn briefly to chapter 26, and let's begin to look at his response to Bildad. In verses 1 through 4, let's just look at the first four verses there. It says, "Then Job answered and said, 'How have you helped him who has no power? How you have saved the arm that has no strength? How you have counseled him who has no wisdom and plentifully declared sound knowledge. With whose help have you uttered words, and whose breath has come out from you? These are rhetorical questions of sarcasm. This is Job's response, basically saying, thanks a lot. Got it. Super helpful, friend. How is this going to help all these people that I've enumerated in my lament who are suffering and oppressed? Those who have no power. How is this giving strength to the arm that has no strength? Where is this kind of wisdom coming from? Where do you think this knowledge is sourced? Verse 4, with whose help have you uttered words, and whose breath has come from you? This is true statements that are absent spiritual insight and wisdom. In other words, Job's commentary on Bildad's speech is, thanks, Bildad, entirely unhelpful and utterly unwise. That's it. Nothing new, not at all sympathetic, and I would add devoid of appropriate humility. Devoid of it altogether. You kind of pick up on this as you look at the next section. Job basically says, I actually know a thing or two about the dominion and power of God as well. Let me articulate some of it here. Look at verse 5 through verse 13. The dead tremble under the waters and their inhabitants. Sheol is naked before God, and Abaddon has no covering. Abaddon, the place of destruction. He stretches out the north over the void and hangs the earth on nothing. He binds up the waters in his thick clouds, and the cloud is not split open under them. He covers the face of the full moon and spreads over it his cloud. He has inscribed a circle on the face of the waters at the boundary between light and darkness. The pillars of heaven tremble and are astounded at his rebuke. By his power, he stilled the sea. By his understanding, he shattered Rahab, another reference to ancient term for destruction. By his wind, the heavens were made fair. His hand pierced the fleeing serpent, which is likely a reference to a constellation or celestial bodies. Notice that he is responding with a little more detail without so much condemnation. In other words, he's articulating similar doctrinal truths about the nature and power and dominion of God by referring to his power over his creation and his power over even the abode of death and destruction. And he's doing this in such a way to hold up God in his glory, not hold God over in his condemnation. When we're in counsel with those who are suffering, is it not true that what we want people who are suffering to be able to do is to see the glory and goodness of God through it and to worship Him? And so he's calling upon this kind of vision of God and His creative wonder and power and dominion. It's unquestioned and unrivaled. And then notice in verse 14. Here's where you have this incredible contrast of humility before the mystery of God's transcendence. Verse 14, behold, these are but the outskirts of his ways. We're not even getting close. And how small a whisper do we hear of him? But the thunder of his power, who can understand? This is the posture of humility. It is so massively distinguished from Bildad's proclamations of theological truth about the dominion and power and authority and holiness and set-apartness of God. Bildad is speaking with certitude. It's as though Bildad is standing next to God and saying, I got this. I'll tell him what you're like. Job, on the other hand, is standing at the feet of this Creator in awe and wonder. In the midst of pain and suffering. And yet he's just saying, I can't even get to the hem of his garment in trying to describe the magnitude of his ways and the wonder of his works. I can't even get close. And in fact, it would do us well to just recognize there is much, much on this side of heaven that we just can't understand. That's the point that runs through all of this. And I think it's so helpful for us to remember that when we are suffering, we need to see the starting point of our questions of why and how long as the starting point of a sincere, heartfelt lament that moves us to a place of longing for God's redemptive purpose and plan to come to fruition so that all things can be made new and all things can be made right. But in the meantime, the fact that we don't know and we don't understand is what is true and best. We cannot be true worshipers of the living God if we are not walking in humility. And yet our inclination is to want to grasp always for certitude and answers to our plaguing questions that become particularly difficult and challenging when we're suffering. We want to know the answer to this injustice. We want to know when will this season end. We have demands in our hearts and our minds that sort of flow out of us, even if they are unspoken. And what we're seeing here is we're seeing this stark contrast between the one who knows a little bit about the dominion and power of God and the separateness of God and his holiness from the sinfulness and the lowliness of man. But he's using that as a weapon to bring down condemnation, whereas Job, in the midst of his suffering and trial, is making a repeated appeal that yes, we lament, and yes, the suffering is pervasive, and yes, it does seem as though the unjust are protected and preserved for time and period that doesn't seem right. And yes, we don't understand. And yes, that's the point. You don't understand. But God does. God will make it right. You can trust in him. All of these messages that Job has articulated that have been running through this all the way back from chapter 1 that we read all the way into chapter 23 and we'll see again. Fighting through all of that is a clenched fist holding on to a confidence in the living God who is just but who I can't know fully until everything is redeemed. I won't know God fully. I won't understand his ways fully until everything is redeemed. Till all suffering is put away. Till all pain is healed. Till everything is redeemed. I won't know and I won't fully understand. So fighting for that or speaking in those terms or counseling others from that posture, unhelpful, unwise, but pointing people to this glorious Creator who we can know, but not know fully, who we can glory in his ways and his works and all of his provision of grace and mercy and even sustenance and life and breath and everything, as the apostle says. We can glory in him even though some of his ways are fully shrouded in mystery. And that keeps us in a state of humble dependence and the right posture for true worship, which is what we need, which is what he's longing for, and is what he actually needs and what will eventually happen. We'll get there. Let's pray.